Greetings to you, my loves. If you are listening to this the week it came out, then that means I'm in Hawaii at a Ram Dass retreat. I go to these once a year, missed last year because of the thing. But if you want to check out the Ram Dass retreat, did you know you can just go to ramdass.org? They're going to be live streaming everything. So if you want to watch me interview some of the wonderful teachers that are going to be at this retreat, you can find it at ramdass.org. The next few intros are going to be bare bones style intros because I am on vacation, but I'm so happy that you are listening to the DTFH, especially this episode. Some time ago, I went on the legendary podcast of Lex Fridman, and I don't know, I think I was feeling a little despondent about the state of the world, and I was talking about how I don't know if I would be able to exercise some of the things I like to think I've learned from Buddhism and meditation and getting to hang out with all these Ram Dass people if I was actually in the situation of someone at war who had just witnessed horror and lost everything. I got lucky because a wonderful meditation teacher actually happened to be listening to that episode. She's friends with Trudy Goodman, who you probably know as Trudy the Love Barbarian from the Midnight Gospel. And Trudy gave her my email and she sent me this wonderful message about compassion and Buddhism. And I realized I gotta have her on the podcast. So with us here today is Melissa McKay. If you want to connect with her, you can find her at melissamckay.net. She has been teaching meditation since the 90s. She is a teacher at Insight LA. You know, one of the wonderful things about the modern times that we live in is if you're interested in any of these teachers, they are an email away. And I would really recommend connecting with her if you are looking for somebody to take you a little deeper into your practice. All the links you need to find her are going to be at duncantrussell.com. And now, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Melissa McKay. Melissa, welcome to the DTFH. It's great to see you.
Great to see you too. Thanks for having me, Duncan.
I wanted to start off with a quote from one of your teachers. And the quote is really brilliant. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement of the mind for real happiness. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement of the mind for real happiness. Mm-hmm. What do you think that means?
Who said that?
This is the problem. I just pasted it in. I didn't write. It's your first teacher. He was the predominant teacher of Vipassana in the world. What, you know his name?
Sayadaw Pandita.
That's it. Thank you. Yep. I can barely pronounce English names. Yes, yep. That's from him.
Excitement in the mind for happiness. Yeah. Yeah, well, you could see that. You know, when we look at the moments that we feel like when our attention isn't really careful or deep or clear, like our regular awareness, what do we call it, like the untrained mind, you know, those times just how we are in the day normally, that we have that kind of anticipatory excitement. But when you calm the mind, you see that it's really a nervous feeling. And that there are states that are actually much more satisfying and deeper and more pleasant, you know, than that kind of anticipatory, excited feeling that we get for something that's going to happen in the future. Maybe that's what Sayadaw Pandita is saying.
It sounds like it. A common thing to say these days, if you are looking forward to something or if you're enjoying something, is not, I'm happy, but I'm so excited. I'm so excited. And then within the expression itself seems to be wrapped up. The anxiety that you're talking about is woven. You can literally, in the way people say it, it's not that it doesn't sound peaceful. It's has its own kind of aggressive undertones to it. Like, I'm so excited. It really does sound like the not what one might equate with happiness. But in my sweeping judgment of my own species as a perfect individual, and I've spoken with other perfect individuals. Many of us perfect individuals have a sense that post-pandemic, or, you know, hopefully the last phases of the pandemic, there is a shared anxiety among people. There is more of us are encountering out in the wild, people losing it, people like blowing fuses publicly. And I mean, there's an entire subreddit called Public Freakout of just people in grocery stores just going nuts. Mm-hmm. And so I bring up this quote because I wonder, is there something deeper going on than just recovering from being locked down? Is there a possibility that this idea is lost to many people, that meaning people think they're looking for happiness, but what they're really looking for is, quote, excitement? So what a disaster if anxiety becomes confused with happiness.
Well, yeah, and but it's always been the case that I remember that being very distinct for me early on in my practice as I started to get more sensitive to myself, which is what mindfulness practice does emotionally. You get more sensitive to what our experiences actually are directly, and feeling that, oh God, being excited is so much just like anxiety, you know, but just with an anticipation of something good rather than an anticipation of something bad. But all of the feelings in the bodies is very, very, very similar. But that's really interesting, that, and I haven't heard that you're saying there's all of these kinds of freak out happening. And is there kind of a residual effect of whatever happened during the lockdown? Did the virus actually have an effect on people's brains or something? Right. Yeah, I don't know. And I have found it particularly hard to, during COVID, it was very easy to teach. And because people were quiet and distractions were removed, it was so nice. And that way, you know.
Yes.
And they had an interest, they were suffering, as we do whenever something happens that is unexpected, or we don't get what we want, or all of those things. There's always a benefit to those kinds of life situations, which are inevitably going to happen to all of us anyways. But they were really easy to teach, and now it's feeling a little bit more difficult to get people to get centered and calm. So I find that fascinating, that there's this freak out thing that's happening among people.
You know, do you buy into the note, like the ages, the yugas? Do you buy into, you know, in the spiritual communities, inevitably, someone will not brush off, but as a kind of general explanation for the world as it is, they'll go, it's the Kali Yuga. We're in the age of disintegration. We're in the age of collapse. These are all things that were prophesized, and this is what we're in. And I do subscribe to that theory. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's an ahistoric way of looking at things. I'm sure, like, if we jump back 500 years, 1,000 years, but the yugas are very long. But if we jump back further back, it would probably seem equally chaotic. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I think to myself, oh, this is compounding. Like, you know, in Buddhism, there's this beautiful analysis, prescription for why if you're feeling this thing, the shared quality that is they call suffering, dukkha, here's why you're feeling it. And the why, I'm going to butcher it, but and how do you just say why? But it has something to do with, like, you're trying to scratch an itch. that, you know, that in the wrong part of your body. It's like, what a disaster if your head itched and you were trying to like scratch your leg. Disaster. And then the intensity of the scratching can like grows, or the method, or that, okay, I'll get a better scratching tool. Clearly the tool is, but it's no, you're scratching the wrong place. But if this were to compound over time, my God, I mean, it is disastrous, apocalyptic even, you know. I know that in Buddhism, you don't run into the cool eschatological stuff you run into in like some of the other religions, but what a prescription for apocalypse.
Yeah.
A shared confusion regarding what happiness is and how to find happiness. And
But remember, it's always been true. It feels like it's heightened to you now, huh? And maybe it is, and maybe it's part of this communication that we're able, access to everything, access to pleasure, access to, you know, I mean, the fact that we can just play any music that we want to at any time. That is a very distinct experience. Right. You know, that's just like pleasure. We can have, you know, fruits from South America. We can have cheese from whatever, you know, and wines from here. It's just like everything is at our fingertips, and we're seeing that, and it's aggravating because it's not actually, you know, building anything that's making us really complete or happy. So, but I like those predictions, and it does seem real, you know, all of the people with their psychedelic experiences having these kinds of different kinds of understandings, and real to me that there's an awakening happening at this particular time. Is that what the Kali Yuga thing means?
Or that, well, I think like after the Kali Yuga, the Maitreya, the idea is that the next Buddha appears, but you've got to get through the Kali Yuga to get to the Buddha, unfortunately. And it's not like it's not a nice hike. It's
not. Yeah. So the prophecy that I've heard that's within the Theravada tradition, and it might be similar to Tibetan tradition, is that this particular dispensation, sasana, they call it, of the Buddhist teachings, this Sakyamuni Buddha will last 5,000 years. So we're kind of halfway through that. And what will happen is fully enlightened beings will disappear from the planet. And each time, and then third stage enlightenment will then disappear, and then second stage, and then first stage will disappear.
There's stages? I'm sorry. After you describe this, I really want to go through the stages of enlightenment.
Okay, good. Yeah. There's lots of reading you can do on that too. I'll try to give a little intro to it. But once those beings start to disappear, then it's kind of like Eckhart Tolle called, you know, free beings kind of frequency holders. Like, wow. They keep us there. You know, we might not even see them, but still they're affecting the beings on the planet. But ethical behavior is supposed to decline. Life expectancy is supposed to go down to 10 years old for humans. Yeah. And then that dispensation will die. And then that's when Maitreya or Maitreya is the Pali word for the Maitreya Buddha will come, who's supposed to have an emphasis of practice of metta, of loving kindness.
Wow. So the next Buddha is going to be like 10 or 8%.
No, because there will be a reemergence, I think, before, but that's a good question. From my understanding, no, like good things will start happening on the earth to enable the Buddha to come. It could be like 80,000 years from now. Like,
Yeah, a long time. It could be, who knows? I mean, look, again, like all of these things, I love these wondering over these things, but generally, like, I know whenever I'm wondering over these things, I'm just trapped in my mind again. I'm doing like karma math. I'm doing yoga math. You know, what is it? This really, truly, if you're like trying to find some peace or happiness, it's not calculating like what part of the Kali Yuga you're in.
It's still good conversation though, because, you know, people that have come to see these things have done so through generating a powerful mind of concentration that enables them to see either different people's minds. I mean, the cities or the psychic powers are a real thing. Have you ever read the Deepa Ma book?
Or no, know I have about not. Deepa Ma?
Oh, you'll love Deepa Ma. She's an interesting Buddhist teacher. Jack knew her.
I've heard of her. I've never read the book.
Oh yeah. But then in that you can see what can happen. This is kind of Buddhist magic, But and it's not magic, it's natural, supernatural. The capabilities of our minds are much more than we tap into in our regular awareness, And what makes them strong is concentration, single-pointed awareness, where distractions are gone, and then the hindrances and afflictions are gone from the mind. And at that point, we become much more powerful beings. And there's a lot of different kinds of possibilities, walking through walls and walking on water. Jesus did it, and apparently, I wasn't there, apparently.
It's almost as though I've got a lot. I mean, look, we can get lost in my theories on what that might be, but observer effect or something, you would expect that, if what they're saying now, there's some like relationship between attention and matter, then you would expect that if that attention shifted, then your experience of matter would probably change with it simultaneously.
Very well said. Really, really nicely said.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, who knows? Who knows? I can't
Yeah,
wait
that
to
sounds
walk through
spot
walls.
on. My experience, that sounds spot
How great. You don't have to look for doors anymore. You're out. Just as long as you're on the first floor, you're great. 'Cause you walk through walls, but can you like manifest steps? That's the question.
Well, you could, because you could change any, the world, the material world is made up of the elements. And so apparently, I haven't tried it yet. I may still, I may. It takes a lot of effort, though. You know
How do
what
you
I'm.
know? That's a good, how do you know until you go walk into a wall? It's like, when was the last time you walked into a wall? Honestly, I haven't in a long time.
Well, that they're made up, that we've got the earth element, so you can change one element into the other element with that psychic power. So you can, out of air, you can build an earth element. And if you read the description of what Deepa Ma was supposed to do, supposed to be able to do, it's very, very fascinating. But for
Oh
your
yeah,
listeners.
well, though, I mean, and the frustrating thing about, and what I love about Buddhism in particular is, because this is a thing, thank God, that is been around for a long time, and because it's real, and because of many people devoting their lives to it generationally, there's maps, there's good maps, and within that, there's also an understanding of like how to deal with perhaps the sudden appearance of what you're talking about, which I think for even for someone who is practicing and is has a great teacher, I think it can be a little unsettling to suddenly have even the slightest vision of these possibilities. You and within that, oh my God, like what a joy for the ego. My God, if I can walk through walls, I'm going to add that to my act. Wait till the audience sees me walk through a wall. I don't know if it'll get a laugh, but it'll definitely be cool. And then, though, so I could, so within it seems like worked into the process is a way to not get too trapped in those various cities that they talk about could potentially emerge.
And that's what you would get for your listeners, that the book is Deepa Ma, and somebody tested her ability back in the 80s to be able to do these things, which she apparently demonstrated. She would never flash. I mean, she had the wisdom to know she would never perform them to gain something personal, attention or recognition. And even me, if I was ever able to develop those, I would never perform them for recognition, because it isn't the point of practice. The point of practice is for the alleviation or eradication of dukkha, of stress.
Yes, and and I maybe this is why it's kind of worked into it as a, as Chögyam Trungpa said, disown it. Just okay, fine, whatever. You turned into a rainbow, great. Well, you still have a mortgage. they're not gonna, they don't care. Turning into a rainbow will not make the banks be like, oh, you turned into a rainbow. Okay, we'll skip this month's payment.
But also, turning into rainbow is a temporary state, so it's also stressful, and anything that is temporary is stressful. And so we're still talking about stress. And as mindfulness, as our mindfulness, which just means our awareness of ourselves increases, we incline our mind towards that deeper kind of happiness that we started this conversation.
episode of the DTFH has been sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, get therapy. You know, speaking of these Ram Dass retreats, when I asked Ram Dass for a bit of spiritual advice, hoping he would say some mystical thing to me, he said, get therapy. And it's actually one of the main things I ignored that he taught me until finally I did it. I got into therapy and it truly changed my life. This meditation stuff is incredible, but there are some things that need the help of a professional, and I am a massive advocate for therapy, which is why I'm thrilled that the podcast is sponsored by the wonderful folks over at BetterHelp. If you are getting that feeling that you would like to find a great therapist, BetterHelp is definitely the way to go. It's the world's largest therapy service. It has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists, available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, which definitely can happen sometimes in therapy, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. You can learn more and save 10% off your first month at BetterHelp. That's HELP.com/Duncan. BetterHelp.com/Duncan. Thanks for sponsoring the show, BetterHelp. I'm curious about your thoughts regarding boundaries, not like psychological boundaries or healthy relationship boundaries, but rather boundaries between the confused mind or the untrained mind and the non-confused mind. And I'm curious your thoughts on that. Like if you were to see the sort of spectrum of consciousness and the potential of the, you know, expansion of the circumference of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. What separates enlightenment from monkey mind? Mm-hmm. Is there even a separation, or are the thoughts themselves repetitive? It was Jack puts it, what does he say, the top 10 like repetitive thoughts. Someone actually just did a study. It was really depressing. Like we think the same things like 80% of the time, just this loop.
No, you don't need one day on a Vipassana retreat and you'll see that. You don't need a study for
it. You've got a skipping neurotic record. Yeah. So, yeah. But I'm curious, where does that stop? Where does it stop? And what is the liminal space between that and what one might call expanded awareness or a deeper way of experiencing one's reality?
One of my teachers told me, one of my main teacher, Bhante Kipapana, who's a monk, and he has a monastery just in Riverside, California, and he's 94 years old now, and he's one of the most profound beings. I've sent a lot of Westerners to him, and they don't tend to stick around for him. He's very subtle, and he's really humble. And I find sometimes Westerners don't like that.
But it's boring. We want a light show.
Yeah.
Exactly. And Pat, we want our backs patted a lot.
Or maybe they think that because he's Asian, that Asians are just more like that. If they saw somebody moving with the grace that he did that were more familiar. I'm not sure why, but anyways, he's a really profound monk, and he continued to practice from the time he was 15 when he became a monk all the way until now. So I enjoy watching him. But one time he told me a fully enlightened being, and we're going back to those four stages of enlightenment, a fully enlightened being, so an arhat, thinks only when they intend to think.
That's awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Yes. Yes. Wow. Cool.
Mastery of the mind, right? Complete mastery. Only
Yeah. Like it's an app.
Because we don't understand that the busyness of our mind, thinking about that and then that and that, and that we're driving, but we're actually rehearsing something that we're going to do later, or we're anticipating a worst case scenario, or we're hating ourselves in some way, or doubting ourselves in some way. And these stories, as we're just driving, imagine that we start to see with Vipassana, with mindfulness, we see that's an energy suck. It takes away, it does something. It's consequential on us. Consequential on our nervous system, you know. So we can't even envision what the freedom of that is like in our regular awareness, but that is what meditation can give for us, is to clear away that. And then we start to see, wow, the mind that is directed, that is to have mastery of the mind, is a glorious thing.
you hear all this stuff, fundamental goodness, emptiness, what's the difference between a thought and fundamental goodness, or what is the difference between an emptiness? Like, is there a difference between a thought and emptiness? In your own experience with emptiness and with thinking, if you had to differentiate the two, what's the difference?
You know, emptiness as a concept isn't used in Theravada practice so much, which is where I was trained and have come from. So I kind of don't understand what the reference is when they're, except for in jhanic practices, of seeing the inherent. Empty is not a word I would use. It's just not a word that I would
use. It's a confusing word.
It's a confusing word. To me, it's a confusing word, but to others that it is not a confusing. I mean, that's the thing about words, you know, is that people hold them differently, or they're meaningful in different ways for different people. So the difficulty of teaching is trying to explain something that is not explainable with these words, you know.
So, may I rephrase the question?
Yeah.
If the mind is, or what we call the mind, is a thought container, meaning that your thoughts are appearing within what many people perceive as the container of identity or self, or that's me, or a lot of people, it's just my head.
Yeah.
What is the difference between the thought forms that appear and the space defining the container itself, whether it's, you want to say, your head, your identity? What are the difference? What's the difference between the two? Is there a difference?
So, there's two minds, right? We have the knowing mind, or consciousness, what we call consciousness, the aware mind, and then there's mind objects. Thoughts are objects of the mind.
Okay.
And so their appearance comes. There's another thing that happens of identity with a thought when we're believing it. That's mine. I am thinking that. I believe that, what I'm thinking. That's kind of a different process of the mind. So as even not, if a fully enlightened person thinks only when they intend to think, when you're like a first stage enlightened person, or a second stage or whatever, or even if you're just meditating, because an aware mind is the moment of that full enlightenment, then there is there's not identifying with the thoughts. I mean, it can be on a very subtle level, but the moment that you know that you're thinking, there's a break in the identification process. You're not just wrapped up in the thought itself, believing the thought itself. And then what's most important is not to get rid of thoughts, but what did the Buddha say is that we're trying to cultivate kusala thoughts. Kusala is mostly translated as wholesome or skillful, which is a word that I've never loved. But what it's really pointing to is those kinds of thoughts that lead towards, and this we can taste in our direct experience. And that's the most important place to taste it, not to think about it, not to theorize about it, but really taste And the Buddha said that when you see these things as unwholesome, when you yourself, not because somebody told you, not because it was written in a book, not because the teacher seems like he's pretty awesome or whatever, but when you yourself see this is not worthy of my, attention, then abandon it. When you yourself see this is beneficial, this is helpful. So that's what wholesome means, those things that we can taste in our experience. So I often ask my students in class to clarify the definition of this word. What is a mind state that you know is not helpful to you? What do you experience as a mind state that is not helpful? You know, and they'll say worry, or they'll say self-hatred, or they'll say fear, or they'll say anger. You can feel it, you can taste it. And afterwards you have remorse when you act on those things. You know, it doesn't, not onward leading, that phrase that I really like.
Onward leading, that's cool. Yeah. Onward leading. Yeah. I like that a lot. I've heard Trump make a distinction between setting sun, rising sun, which I think might be a similar way of sort of, you know when the sun's coming up, you know when the sun's coming down. It's as simple can be.
Because we have to be careful in our, and I don't know if it's particularly culturally, but I think it is Western culture. We really have to be careful with puritanical kind of thinking of good and bad and right and wrong and judgmental. And within Buddhist psychology, and what is Buddhism? All it is, you know, the Buddha said, apparently, I teach one thing and one thing only, stress and the end of stress. That's what it is. There's no belief set. There is a cosmology. We were talking about it a little bit. There are these other abilities, but it is just a practical psychological tool, really. And it's working with the mind and alleviating the mind from the causes of suffering, which are very powerful in all of us. And that first noble truth that there is dukkha in the world is just pointing to the fact that you look around. I did this in my Sunday class. I said, just this morning, if you could reflect on your morning, what is something that you experienced that was stressful? And for me, I was playing pickleball and I felt nervous. I woke up kind of grumpy. I had three different mind states just that day that were stressful. And so everybody shared, they all had the same thing. And it was really beautiful because everybody who feels so trapped and alone in that, feel like it's a particular problem to them. And that's what that first noble truth is, to alleviate that. This is me, this is mine. No, this is just what we get as humans. This, what you described in the mind and all of the negative mind states that come with that. But the important thing is there's a cure for it.
Well, nobody wants that, really. I mean, the great meditation teachers like you, so good at, like, you understand. And I think the reason you understand is because you've been through many of these phases. I don't know what phase of enlightenment you might be. Most meditation teachers don't really get into that at all. Diagnosing themselves as like, I'm in 3C enlightened being or whatever, which we appreciate on the other side of the fence. And I like that you're replacing suffering with stress. It's easier for people to understand. Sufferings of stress we get. Suffering, what does that even mean? Like you get stuck in a trap or something. I've never been stuck in a bear trap. That when I picture suffering, I think of a wild animal in a trap. You know, so it's hard for me. But you're in a wild animal in a trap. The trap looks like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Except the problem being, like, wild animals, they're not born in these traps, and humans are not born in the traps, but our memory banks don't record the pre-trap situation. So we begin to associate the trap with who we are. We paint the trap, we tell stories about the trap, take pictures of the trap, find other people with the same trap, go out drinking with them, dancing with them, marry them. Have children with them, and then give the traps to our children. You're going to wear the trap your father wore. What is this new trap? It's ridiculous. But I want to point something out to me that I think gets left out, and I get why. This is an apocalypse. Buddhism, I get it. It's if your trap is your identity. We're talking apocalypse, and the in the sense of, like, this is even a glimpse, as I'm sure you've had, of life minus the trap. just a glimpse. You know, they talk about the possibility of realizing, you know, this thing that you have thought is real, it's not quite as real as you might have thought. In fact, yeah, there's no trap there. It's the worst kind of imaginary friend. It's not even there. And if you get one, not an intellectual, like, I think I know what you mean, but an actual for a second, the transparency of it all.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Sounds like you've had that glimpse.
I hesitate to report spiritual progress because inevitably it means I'm about to get in a fight with my wife. It's like right when I think that I'm like, I did it. It's like, no. So I will not report it. I'm just.
But a glimpse is not a claiming of a forever state. You know, the glimpses are so important. They're so important.
I see how they might be, but we started our conversation offline talking about clinging. And I really loved the email you sent me, and I spent a long time thinking about it. And upon realizing for a second this other the other possibility, the life without stress thing, and then not just realizing it intellectually, or you hear people like you talking about it, or you see someone who, for whatever reason, doesn't seem like they're on fire all the time.
Yeah.
You have some faith or something. But then for a second, you're like, okay, now look at your life. Now, what about this? There's no stress. You're not freaking out. You've been freaking out for 2 decades straight. You've been freaking out for 2 decades straight. Why have you been freaking out? You've been freaking out because you're addicted to freaking out. You are so invested in the freak out that it has become like when you go to the dentist and they're like, oh my God, calcified shit all over your teeth. And then you realize, what? I don't want to let go. That's what I want to talk about. I don't want to let go. Don't know how to function in that world. It's a different world. And in fact, I don't exist in that world. And can you speak to that level of neurosis? Are there people who glimpse phase one enlightenment and are like, you know, I'm going to pass. I think I'm just going to walk around with a trap.
No, not at the first stage of enlightenment. That's when you, no. But that part's not important. It's too theoretical. But the other part of clinging and our original email, it's really important to see. I heard something in your conversation with Lex that felt familiar to the way I kind of, the part of Buddhism that didn't excite me. And then as I continued on in my practice, I started to realize the parts that weren't exciting me were because I wasn't understanding the concepts correctly. I was misunderstanding the concepts. So, and many people do this idea of the translation of the word is upadana, translated very often as attachment. And another translation is clinging. And so many people come across that and they feel like, well, if I'm not attached to the people that I love, then how is that, what exists in free of attachment? It sounds very cold. It sounds callous. It doesn't sound interesting at all.
Spock,
right?
Vulcan, Spock. It sounds Spock.
Yes, exactly. Which is not at all the case. When we look very closely, and again, this is best understood in everybody's direct experience, not in my explanation of it. But when we look really closely, so I'm just pointing to everybody's hearts now, that we're all the same, is that we attach in these various ways. The Buddha never even mentioned people that we attach to. But if the definition, I brought it up because I thought you'd bring it up. But the definition of upadana, the different kinds of clingings we do, we attach to things being pleasant, particularly at the sense door. So there's other kinds of pleasure that we experience, but sensual pleasure, touch, you know, smell, all of our 5 senses,
yes,
or the 6th sense being that of the mind. So what happens when we're in a relationship with anybody, whether a spouse or a child, or and we want it to be a pleasant experience? You know, nobody provides that for us all the time, you know, right. Our relationships are going to be unpleasant at different times, whether they smell bad or they look bad or whatever, you know, that's so clinging. It's so easy to see how that creates harm within a relationship and actually prevents us from really loving them, from seeing them as a precious human being. And in fact, those two things are mutually exclusive. I think I saw a quote from Osho that said that attachment and love are mutually exclusive, and they're not existent in the mind at the same time. We can go back and forth between feeling attached and then loving and da-da-da-da-da-da, because the mind moves that quickly. But when we're attached, we're pretty blinded to another being. We were like, I want this to be pleasurable, and then now it's gone away. Now I'm resenting the person, you know, like a lot of things can compound on top of that. And then the other way of attaching is to our ideas about them. And so even if we, and I hope this doesn't sound callous or Vulcan either, but even if we want somebody to be, we cling to the ideas. Right now, I've had a very difficult couple of weeks because my brother, who was living with me, had a series of seizures, and he's been in the ICU unconscious for the last.
I'm sorry.
And not regaining consciousness. And so, you know, the attachment is my ideas of how things should be right now. And of course that creates stress. And we're going to do that still. Only fully enlightened people don't do that. So it's not to shame this, the idea of clinging and attachment, but to become very familiar and intimate with it, aware of it when it's present in us, and learning how to sit with its with its suffering. And we do that, it doesn't stay as long, you know. We can process the grief or the non-acceptance or the resistance of reality that we're going through, because we learn to sit with that feeling of clinging, it should be like this. So to ideas, we're clinging to ideas. Ideas aren't reality. The reality is where this person is, my brother is right now, the state and condition that he is right now.
I want to thank Lumi Labs for supporting this episode of the DTFH and for creating the greatest edible on earth. I'm an old man now, and I don't have the time or the capacity to go through a nervous breakdown if I'm going to take an edible. And also, my vision's a little weird these days. I don't want to measure it out or risk it or wonder if just maybe I didn't eat the right amount of edible, but in fact took an MK Ultra dose of THC, which is going to send me into some kind of dark spiral, which is why I love Lumi Labs microdose gummies. My friends, these are perfect edibles. After a lifetime of experiencing various edibles, I could not vouch more strongly for an edible than beautiful microdose gummies offered to us by Lumi Labs. Even better, they're available nationwide. You can fly with this wonderful medicine. That's right. You can just order them somehow. Y'all are lucky. In my day, if we wanted to find an edible like this, you'd have to travel to California, go up to Humboldt County, follow a rainbow to a little creek, and talk to a dude with a hat that was made for him personally by elves. Not anymore. Now, all you have to do is go to microdose.com, use code Duncan to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, it's microdose.com, code Duncan. You are going to love these wonderful, wonderful edibles. Lumi Labs, thank you so much for supporting this podcast.
Ideas aren't reality. The reality is where this person is, my brother is right now, the state and condition that he is right now.
Oh my God. This is not, you know, when that stuff has happened to me, my first response is, I just think this isn't fair.
Yeah.
I got to negotiate here. Who do I talk to? Do you have a manager? Is there a manager I could talk to here? This is ridiculous. Who's running this? Are you kidding? It's me. You don't do this to me. You're doing this to me. That's my mom. You don't give my mom cancer. Who am I talking to? This is insane. How is this? This is as unfair as unfair. Man, I get just smashed. And you just end up like one of those, you know, you see the bird trapped in the house. And it's so sad, smashing into the window, smashing in the window. The window is, the bird doesn't meditate enough for it to fly right through. But it's you know, it's so sad. And then that's how I react to what you're talking, events at that level. Yeah. That's my go-to is, this isn't fair. I deserve better than this. Are you kidding me? And I get mad. I get mad.
Exactly. And that's human. And so our job at this level that we are at now is not to say, well, don't do that. You're just creating more suffering when you do that. But what mindfulness is not shaming that part of ourselves, but really being able to sit with that as an internal reality. You know, we've got the external reality, the internal reality denies it. And once we do, we start to see, this isn't changing anything, and it's making me suffer a lot more. And then And then so we wake up and mature more, and then we can more accept the realities that life isn't going to do what we want it to do.
It's easier to be angry. I mean, it's easier. It feels easier to be angry than to sit with that heartbreak. I mean, the heartbreak is all sweet. It's vulnerable. It's just love. It's like when it's a baby smiling at you when you sit with it long enough. But the baby is, it's like, I don't want the baby to be dealing with this. And I am sorry that you're going through this. And I appreciate you coming on the podcast as you're going through something like this. What I love about Vipassana, as I understand it, which I don't think is a very clear understanding, is this invitation to go to that place, to open the door, go in the room, and the room that you've been, a lot of us have been like actively, aggressively avoiding. And when for me, glimpses of recognizing that the thing I thought was the worst thing seems to be the best thing about me, or the best thing I've ever, it seems ridiculous that this thing actually, your whole life you've been running away from this gift that is inside of you.
That's what Vipassana practice does. It is a shedding of the layers, and you really do feel like you get down to something that was so familiar and somehow forgotten. That's the sense of it. And then, of course, so rich and satisfying and deep, you know, deeply satisfying, deeply, deeply satisfying. But Vipassana is just an exploration of our consciousness, and it's the only tool to do it, you know. It's got this word that is a language we don't understand, but it's near to all of us. It's not a Buddhist thing. It's a reality. It's a way of exploring consciousness, because you can't, as Matthieu Ricard said, you can't look at, doctors can't measure, look at, they know nothing about consciousness. There's no tool or instrument to look at consciousness. And the only way to do that is in the first person. And so that's what Vipassana does. Let's look at sadness, let's look at grief, let's look at this body and sensation and emotion and feeling and the way the mind and the body are connected. And so Vipassana is called insight meditation, because these are the insights you see. You have insights. These aren't Buddhist insights. They're insights into nature. So the translation of Vipassana is to see nature. We're just looking at reality, the reality of thought. You know, explore. What are thoughts? Look at them. If you want to know the mind, sit down and look at it, said Munindra, I think. That's the only way to do it. And Vipassana is a technique and a tool to do that. We have to sustain the mind and attention and concentration so that it is able to see things on a more subtle level. We have a real scattered mind. We're only seeing things on a grosser level. But once concentration comes there, the mind can start to perceive things on a deeper level. You can, hear a sound and see it right through the, sometimes like a psychedelic will help you to heighten the senses to be able to.
I've heard that.
Yes.
This.
So that's what Please. It is. And it alleviates stress because you're looking at in the mind, what is the cause of stress? And it's a reality for everybody. And it's a universal truth that we start to see. Just like if we jump into the ocean, we know that other people will get wet from the water because we have when we did it, right? And so same in the mind, we start to see these things are universal truth. So necessary for you to go on a Vipassana meditation retreat.
I got kicked out of the last one. I'm not allowed to go. I'm banned from all my Vipassana retreats.
What did you do?
Walk through a wall into the ladies' bathroom. I didn't know it was there. I just learned to walk through a wall. I did not mean to do it, but they were like, and then I tried to walk back out, and because I was freaked out or whatever, I just slammed into the wall, so nobody believed me. They thought I was a creep or something, So then, they're like, "You're banned. You can't do it."
Yeah.
I do want to go. My wife is like, we have kids, so like finding the space to do it and everything, the old story, but my wife is really encouraging me to do it, which is awesome because it means she's going to be out of contact with me for, I think 10, it's, what's it, 10 brutal days. And but I am interested. I'm really interested in the, I feel like I have noticed that all the rotten emotions that I was experiencing and trying to avoid are not quite as rotten as I thought they were. And then because of that, I'm not freaking out as much, which is great. But I'm interested in this because I'm just, and the reason I keep asking you these annoying questions about the boundary between this and that is just because I'm fascinated by the, and I love what Munindra said regarding, look, just go look at it. Don't ask me. You want to know what the Mona Lisa looks like? Go to the Louvre. But when you're talking, disappointing. But when you're talking to someone who is trained, I feel like it's important to kind of get some ideas regarding what is thinking regarding the content of pain or the content of suffering or the components of what one might call stress. And similarly with boredom, we all say we're bored. No one, what is boredom? Define it for me. So how, if you had to define stress, not just as it's a shitty feeling, but what is it to you?
I think it's a shitty feeling is the best definition of it. I really think so. Because, and what does it say in the First Noble Truth? The Buddha said, birth is stress, right? Did you see your wife give birth?
Yes.
Yeah, so you saw stress. That's dukkha. There's some pain and suffering there.
Right? Oh, for her? I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. For me, it was very stressful.
Yes. And, being separated from those we love is stress. Things happening that we don't want to happen, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want.
That's causes. Can you let's say, and again, it's describe red. That's an annoying question. But if you had to describe, and not red as well, it's the color of blood, but describe suffering to me, or I'm sorry, stress to me. From the perspective of someone who has done countless, countless hours of meditation, how, I'm an alien. I come from the best planet ever. We don't know what stress is. Describe it to me. Not the causes. What is it?
Thoughts in the head and feelings in the body that are unpleasant and uncomfortable. And so when we're feeling stressed, that's all that's happening. There's thoughts in the head that are stressful And then and that in itself would be a fine thing because it doesn't hurt that much mentally. It's when it comes into our bodies, Vedana, the feeling tone and the sensation that it experiences. You know, it makes us feel sick or tight or, you know, just pretty much not well, not clear, not happy, not content. Is that a good description? But you know it well. You experience it daily. You're probably experiencing it on some level right at this moment.
Tightly. I'm going to throw out a few, then you throw a few back to me. Like a party game. Tightly coiled anaconda wrapped around heart chakra.
You're much better with that than I am. You're so good with descriptive words. That's great.
It's so dense. It's tight. It's the classic is just like diaper rash, except it's in your soul. Your soul has diaper rash or whatever is your soul is hanging out in. It's a rashy ache that is unremitting, unrelenting, like that. Can you give me a few from your own experience with it?
No, I just love that you're doing that because it's so helpful to people that would follow you and listen to your podcast and whatever successes you've had in the world and the friends that you keep, you know, you're so cool, all of these kinds of things. And what people get disconnected from is that, you know, and it's so great. And I've learned this as a teacher too. I assume that people know that I'm full of all that stuff that you just described. Yeah. But they don't. And so it really is, as a teacher, it's a new learning that I have to share that with people. I have to share that I experience these things because it really helps people to not shame themselves when they are going through that experience or to think now that they're a Buddhist, they should no longer be having these kinds of experiences, the lust and the craving and the anger and the rage and the, all of those things and just the pain of it all. Shame we can do without in our spiritual practice. It's such a hindrance to our spiritual practice. We have to let that one go. So, and that is a great healer. What you're doing right now and sharing that with people is very helpful to just see this is the first noble truth. Pain and suffering.
Yeah. It's expert. Expert on the first noble truth. That's where it stops. So if you're ever giving a class, I could come in for the very first part. That's it.
That's but, not true. You've seen the alleviation of stress. You have.
I have.
Yeah.
And that's a thrilling thing. And, you know, I'm lucky. I work with David Nichter. He's an amazing teacher. And he so knows me so well that he understands, like, my grasping mind really wants to, like, kind of retire after sitting in a hotel and having a fleeting glimpse of something that I've been hearing about for a long time. Yeah. But I just am really interested in the, I guess I'm getting too detailed. I'm just very interested in the quantum properties of suffering. What are we talking about here? I mean, we are talking about the engine of war. We're talking about the coal that starts all the fires that cause all the problems. And so little is being, we know how to split an atom. That's incredible. We're about to have fusion. But what about the fundamental cause of the reason we need fusion reactors now? It's because we want so much that we got to keep things moving. The reason we want to split the atom, because we want more energy or want to kill a bunch of people. The impulse behind it is this annoying anaconda thing. So I am curious about it and really curious your thoughts on why is it that when you stop running away from it and just put your attention on it, why is it that it changes into something not so bad or nothing at all? What's happening there? What is this relationship? Can you tell me what this is? What's going on here?
difference between delusion and seeing clearly. That's it. It's delusion always, the not seeing of the suffering that makes it perpetuate. We don't see it. So what did Buddha say whenever, Mara is the personification of all of these afflicted states or whatever? He would say just very simply, and I think compassionately, Mara, I see you. And so that's what we're doing when we practice mindfulness practice, is just seeing. I wasn't looking at this before. We're not looking. We're not aware of ourselves in life when it's happening, which is in the present moment. We're constantly thinking about something else. It's not good or bad, but it, or right or wrong, but it does perpetuate stress, And so the seeing of it, we see the futility of the mind, which we're living in all of the time. And that's be unnerving for people to hear how very frequently. And that's what a Vipassana retreat will do too, is go, I am crazy.
That's what I hear.
But
it's not I that am crazy. It is this human experience that is, and the thinking mind that prepares. And of course we have beauty in that. And that's what clarifies. That's what clarifies from mindfulness practice. It automatically recedes and reduces the negativity of the mind, all of the affective states and the neurosis. That's how it came to me. That word felt very real to me on an experience I had. This is just the neurosis, And we have all the other beautiful things. We help each other. I have felt so much empathy coming in my direction from this experience I've been having with my brother. Like we connect. There's support. There's love. There's human connection, which is not the same as attachment, generosity, and those things grow. So it's not about annihilating everything, but growing. The Buddha said, cultivate the good. It is possible for you to cultivate the good. If it weren't possible, I wouldn't tell you to do so. If this cultivating of the good were to bring you suffering, I wouldn't tell you to do so, but because it leads to benefit and pleasure, therefore I say to you, cultivate the good. So that's what the word bhavana, which is the translation of, that we translate as meditation, means. It means to cultivate. So meditation is just habituating the mind towards things that are onward leading. And every mind is filled with this kind of self-hurting mechanism. We're all doing it. Useless, futile ways that the mind perpetuates stress within us. Constantly.
This holiday season, if you're looking for a unique gift that inspires curiosity, travel, and culture, give the gift of Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that's sold more than 10 million subscriptions. Thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy bite-sized language lessons, you'll finally be able to discover the wonder that comes with learning a new language. I have used Babbel. It's fantastic. I don't know if you're like me and have had rotten experiences with other language learning apps out there, or just a rotten experience in high school with learning a new language, but Babbel fixes everything. It's addictive, it's fun, and most importantly, it helps you learn a new language. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, get up to 55% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/Duncan. That's babbel.com/Duncan for up to 55% off your subscription. Babbel, language for life.
doing it. Useless, futile, ways that the mind perpetuates stress within us constantly.
Well, I mean, and then this is where it gets really interesting, doesn't it? Like, oh, you identify that. Now you go to war with your mind. Now what you do is you break your mind into two pieces. It's like, okay, here's the non-cultivated bad part of the garden. Now here's the good part of the garden. I'm going to start supplying weapons to the good part of the garden. We're going to, this is where, you know, in the psychedelic community, someone needs to start working with language, because how many psychonauts do you hear who obliterated, destroyed, shattered, crushed their ego? All the languages, the way they describe their experience is like, why would you do that to yourself?
I understand that. But, you know, again, we're going back to language there, and that those words are used in what it depends is if that word brings up aversion for you, which it did for me. Saidu Pandita was a big teacher about going into battle over it, and it would bring up anger in me. I thought I had to use, but we have to understand that the weapons that we use in this battle are compassion, they're loving kindness, they're awareness itself. And when we get used to using those weapons, then crushing and obliterating and annihilating, those words don't. They're a bit more meaningful, but we do have to be careful, because you do have to go in with, and even the ideas of good and bad and right and wrong are not good. It's what leads to stress and what does not. Cause and effect. There's a cause and effect. That's an observable law in this universe, called karma, translated as kama or karma, you know, but it's observable. You can see that the mind is the forerunner of all things. When we think, act, or speak from a certain mind state, it's consequential, and we can change that. That's changeable.
Yeah. My mundane way of understanding it is, I'm friends with a bunch of comedians. Some of them are known as, like, they're roast comedians, meaning they have perfected the ability to analyze someone and say the cruelest, funniest thing you've ever heard. But the only reason they can do it and have the audience like them is because behind it is love. Yeah. And when a comedian is getting roasted, they laugh. It's not a fake laugh. It's because there's a weird camaraderie there. At the moment people are doing that as comedians, and that's not there, they instant lose the audience. They don't like it. No one wants to see someone get savaged and their feelings hurt. So, but I know what you mean by this kind of, like, compassionate wrathfulness, that when there's love behind it, it works. But when there isn't, it's just going to throw up someone's defense mechanism. So maybe in the identification of the untamed, uncultivated mind, there's a possibility to be loving to that part of oneself, but for me, still wrathful.
I had to incline my mind in that way, but I had to stop using the anger and everything. As I heard these battle analogies, I was like, oh, that's not effective. And I've had teachers that are really good at seeing your, you know, watching your motivation. It will creep in sometimes, or greed will creep in. We're trying to achieve something spiritually, and that's an interference in our practice also, you know. The greed and hatred as the motivating factor is not good. So it just takes an inclination. Okay, kindness instead. But I love that you said that about comedians too. And I feel like I've always been a big fan of comedy from the time I was a little kid. And what I love about it is the ability to laugh at and point out the absurdity. Those are the great comics, like, of this human existence.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, yes, and when it's done right, I just saw a great comedy show last night, and it's like, I still am just so happy just from the experience of, like, whoa, just seeing that is really nice. But let me pat myself on the back some more for being a comedian. Do you have a little bit more time? I know I can't believe you gave me an hour of your time right now. More aware of what, I wish I could help. I'm the worst at, like, I don't even know how to respond to things like that. I don't, I know you're not supposed to say, I'm sorry, but then you're not supposed to, you know, there's all these things you're not supposed to do.
Who says? I don't know.
I read it somewhere. Don't say you're sorry.
I don't know
what else to say. I'm like, Jesus, that sucks.
You don't have to. Glad I'm not you.
Yeah. Me too. I'm glad I'm not me. Okay. And I'm going to shut up about this stupid boundary thing. What is the action of self-compassion? Like, who is being compassionate to who here? I have a sense that really there's some imaginary boundary here or something that's causing a lot of problems, and that once you see past that boundary, or it's just, I mean, God, I mean, you know, everyone wants a nice view. Everybody wants a house with a nice view. And yeah. I don't know if you saw the Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David is like, you really like the view. You just look at the view a few times. You don't care about the view anymore. In this situation, it's kind of like, you know, a prisoner gets moved, moving a prisoner from solitary confinement to a cell with a simple little window overlooking anything is going to be for that prisoner the greatest thing that ever happened to them. It's like, my God, I can see out. So is it possible to really be compassionate to oneself? Like, I can lift a thing with my hand. I can move stuff around. But is this thing you're talking about a result of seeing something a little more expansive, and then that thing naturally it is being compassionate to the little you that you thought was all of you? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you know, the compassion is a cultivated mind state, right? And it arises, we should understand it. It needs to be studied by meditation to really understand what compassion is, because people use that word and for codependency sometimes, or for guilt, or for there was another one, I don't know. But anyways, we can mistake our emotions. Real compassion is a desire to alleviate, a wish for somebody to alleviate their pain and suffering. So the freedom, wish of beings to be free from suffering, wishing ourselves to be free from suffering. Who is doing that? What is that great question? And you can keep asking that, because that might obliterate your ego.
So, crush it. Shatter
might
it.
Question.
Incinerate it.
It could do all of those things. And, you know, again, it's answerable and direct experience only, but we are distinct beings, right? If I pinch myself, you don't feel it. Right. We have a mind and we have a body. The I part is a psychological component of the mind that says, I am that. It makes ourselves permanent and forever. But what we are is a being that is changing and in a constant state of change. There's nothing solid. And even this very being, this identity, is going to change and transform at some point, apparently. And I mean, we know we're going to die, but apparently it changes. Then the mind finds another body, apparently. Mm-hmm. But we don't even have to discuss that. We can just look within our own lives and know from 10 years ago how much we've changed, or from when we're a baby, how much we've changed. So what we start to see with insight is that we're, Ram Dass says, a changing series of events. We are distinct individuals, though, and so it's not a no self in that way. But as Thanissara Bhikkhu says, the Buddha said to relate to things as not self. This is not me. This is not mine. This I am not, because it's that mental process of identifying with something that brings a lot of pain and stress. It's really helpful to do with our difficult emotions too. You know, I mean, so much gets compounded on people and their suffering if they experience loneliness, or if they experience a problem in life. And that can be very helpful, but this is not me. This is not personal. This is not myself. You know, yeah. People identify with the broken parts of their self. They identify with those parts that are broken. I am a this kind of person. People report to me all the time. They come to my classes. My mind is always wandering. I'm like, okay, who else? Not everybody. Like, okay. It's so funny what we call I. It's so funny what we call I.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really interesting phenomena that maybe we'll get, you know, sometimes I wonder, is Buddhism or insight, whatever you want to call it, really like a short-term fix for a like problem with a brain that got too big too fast, and mm-hmm. we just got confused, and now that confusion has become culture, and everything that we call civilization is just a byproduct of this sort of, the neocortex grew too fast, something happened.
it's broader than just that. I mean, this is talking about realms of existence and the cure for anyways, we won't speculate, but do you practice mindfulness?
I do. Yes, yeah. I do.
And after you practice, do you feel some benefit?
I do.
That's the most important thing, to just always look at that. And it never stops. In my experience, you'll see it's always, and the benefits just get deeper and deeper and deeper and better. Better, and the healing of that ache in the soul that you described is available, and it will just keep happening.
Good news. That's good news. And
but always connect your mind with that cause that you put in of your meditation practice to the effect, and the cause you put in at a night of drinking to the effect, and the cause that you put in when we lose our tempers to the effect, and the cause that you put in for being generous and helpful to people to the effect.
Because, that's cool.
Well, that's what mindfulness is. It's just paying attention. And when we do that.
Oh, then I don't practice mindfulness. I'm sorry. I thought it was something else.
What do you do?
I'm just kidding. Well, I practice, but I practice mindfulness the way I practice doing abdominal exercises. I mean, you know, you see someone at the gym, you're like, Jesus, look at that. So yes, but I'm going to start practicing mindfulness now. Thank you. Do you do these Vipassana retreats yourself? I want to go to the one you run.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you when I do. I don't have one scheduled right now. I really want to offer them freely, and I'm just waiting for that ship to come about. I just want to offer them, for that's how all my retreats were. And
yeah,
I just want to offer them freely. And in the West, they've become so much a part of this, and they have to in, you know, various ways. So there's places that have offered me to come, but I want it to be free.
You could have us bring our own food or something.
Well, there's all kinds of ways. And I feel like, you know, Sayadaw Pandita said, you put your mind on something in a wholesome intention, it will manifest. So it will manifest. But I will let you know if I do a retreat.
Thank you.
For sure. Yeah.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for answering my lopsided questions, Melissa. It's really been a joy chatting with you. And just thank you for, out of the blue, sending a really powerful email to me. That has become a koan, and I think about it. There were part for a second, I'm like, no, no. And then I'm like, oh, it's totally right. And then you're a great teacher, because I always, you know what, I'm now, if something annoys me when I read it at first, I'm like, no way, way. I'm like, oh shit, it's good. This is good. What's in there? It didn't annoy me, but you know what I mean? It wasn't even challenging, but it disrupted some confusion that I was having. And I really appreciate the time you took to write it. That was very kind of you, and thank you. I look forward to talking to you more in the future if you have time, and much love to your brother.
Oh yeah.
Where can people find you?
I teach a weekly class on Zoom. MelissaMcKay.net is the easiest way. That has all the things.
Great. All the links you need to find Melissa will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Thank you so much, Melissa. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan.
That was Melissa McKay, everybody. If you want to connect with her, all the links will be at DuncanTrussell.com. A big thank you to our beloved sponsors, and thank you for listening. Remember, if you want to tune in to the Ram Dass retreat, all you got to do is go to ramdass.org, and all the links will be there. They'll also be in the description of this episode. I'll see you next week. Until then, Aloha.